I'm so excited to have Danny Goldberg on the phone with me. His book is In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. One of the things I wanted to know, and Danny has been a journalist and a music executive, is how long in the planning was this? I mean, your timing's impeccable. It's the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love.
Well, the actual decision to write the book happened pretty quickly. I had dinner at the holiday around Christmas of 2015 with my literary agent, and she was talking about the fact that she thought there'd be a market for 50th anniversary books about 1968, and I just had this visceral reaction because I'm very much a child of the 60s, have paid attention to a lot of the movies and books and TV specials that have come out about the 60s, and I always felt that 68 is kind of was overcovered because it had those dramatic, catastrophic assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and the protests outside the Democratic National Convention, and, you know, very, very important year in America's history. But to me, the 60s essence that inspired me so much as a teenager peaked in 67. So I, over the Christmas break, wrote a proposal and we were able to sell it in the spring, and then I had to deliver it in November. So the actual writing of the book happened quite quickly. I was just kind of immersed myself in reading everything I could get my hands on and listening to what was listenable and talking to a few dozen people. But the underlying ideas that are in the book had been with me for many decades because it is a period that touched me so personally. 67 was the year I graduated from high school, and I wasn't a participant in the events that I described, but I was a avid fan of them. You know, I was mesmerized by reading about Muhammad Ali refusing the draft and coming out against the war in Vietnam, and Dr. King coming out against the war, and the explosion of interest in Haight-Ashbury and the hippie phenomenon that really became public outside of the Bay Area in 67. And the Beatles meeting the Maharishi and suddenly introducing this word meditation into the language, and the explosion of rock and roll in general that year as the album became the principal art form, and so many artists, The Doors, Velvet Underground, Pink Floyd, Grateful Dead, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin all made their first record that year. So I had an emotional connection to it, and I knew what I was looking for. But the actual writing of the book happened rather quickly over the course of around 9 months.
One of the things that I was so pleased by about the book is that, as our mutual Facebook friend, well, probably your real friend in real life, Sheila Weller, did a lovely review of the book in the Times, and as she said, writing about that time has come to carry, as she put it, writing without cynicism carries risk. And this is something that's bugged me as well. You're a year ahead of me, you know, in going through that particular time. But it's always haunted me. There's been a kind of confusion, longing, nostalgia, and some trauma, which I think is you detail in the book as well, because there was sort of the bright, glowing peace side, and then there was kind of a dark side. But over time, it's bugged me, and I think it may have bugged you, that the era has been sort of denigrated and dismissed.
Well, firstly, I've never met Sheila Weller. I'm very grateful for the review that she wrote of my book, and I hope I get to meet her sometime. But that was a very gratifying that she was so generous in the New York Times about the book. I'm aware of her books, but we've never met. There's no question that there's a lot of baggage just that the word hippie has. Because it became famous so quickly as the media descended on Haight-Ashbury and covered these events. The baby boom generation was the biggest in history. Most of the media then, as now, was fueled by advertising. Advertisers wanted this young generation, and so there was, you know, what was kind of a subculture in small neighborhoods. Over many decades, the so-called bohemian culture almost overnight became mass culture, and that both expanded the footprint of it and killed it almost within months of each other. That's why I feel kind of by the end of 67, a lot of the spirit, the external symbol certainly of the counterculture, long hair on guys and language like hip and far out man and groovy and cool, and the you know, some of the protest slogans, some of the clothing, became drained of meaning as they became so exposed that sort of people copied them, and they became just sort of part of the big media machine, and sort of this dumbed down cartoon version of the hippies and counterculture became what was left. And I always say, if I'd been born 10 years younger, I'm sure I would have been attracted to the punk culture that had contempt for the cartoon version of hippie.
Mm-hmm.
And also, anytime you're involved with sort of spiritual ideas, you're going to inspire mockery and contempt from you know, materialists and people who feel that it's all a scam. And of course, there are a lot of scams done in the name of spirituality, but that doesn't mean that they're all scams. And at the same time, you had a political counter-revolution that was very offended by the protests against the war in Vietnam, that was threatened by the questioning of materialism. They saw it as a questioning of capitalism. You know, there were all sorts of think tanks and conservative organizations that devoted a lot of time to denigrating and the counterculture. So between the self-destructiveness of bad drugs, the media overkill, the right-wing reaction to it, and the general kind of hubris that some people in the counterculture got after it became such a media phenomenon, that the origins of it became obscured, the sweetness and idealism and delicacy of it became overwhelmed by kind of simplistic slogans. And in that sense, I know exactly what she meant. There is sort of the risk of just people making fun of it, because there's plenty to make fun of. But to me, what interests me is the spirit behind all of those symbols.
Mm.
And it's a spirit that I do remember and I feel is a beautiful one. And I think that it was at heart a spiritual movement, a reaction to materialism on the one hand and kind of some of the narrower aspects of organized religion on the other. And I think it's a spirit that's, had a big influence 50 years later. Didn't create a perfect world, didn't eliminate greed and violence from the world, neither did the life of Jesus Christ or Buddha or the Enlightenment or technology or science. But I think that there's an energy there that reverberates, certainly influenced the development of the Internet, helped launch the environmental movement, created a climate where there's so-called New Age and other pathways, whether it's yoga, mindfulness, or all these things, you know, emanate from there. I'm a proud
survivor
of the hippie culture, but yeah. not the cartoon version of it.
Yeah,
The elusive real culture.
I appreciate that distinction. You know, I was watching the other night, I don't know if you caught it, you've probably seen others like it in research for the book, a PBS special on their series, The American Experience. And this was Summer of Love, but it was put out in 2007. So I guess they were doing the 40th anniversary.
Oh, okay.
Right? And it was a nice precursor to talking to you today, because it was a very contained depiction of the year that you do focus on in many ways, going from like January 14th, 1967, the Golden Gate Park be-in,
yeah,
in San Francisco, and then Leary's infamous dropout speech, turn on, tune in, dropout. And as you said so accurately, there were like 90 million people at that time under the age of 25. And as this thing happened as a kind of pilgrimage, if you will, to Haight-Ashbury, it's almost like the center couldn't hold. Like there was this beauty that even the townies reflected on. Hey, these kids are okay. You know, they're spreading peace and love, and they're really being very generous. The diggers were doling out free food. And then it got almost too congested, way, way, way too congested, with the influx in July of, say, 100,000 plus. And tourists were coming to gawk and so forth. And the thrust of the PBS special is that it got to be sort of a mess. You know, that there were bad drugs. There were too many runaways who were really not being cared for. And so there was then a kind of exodus. And it really was a somewhat condensed period. Do you think that's true?
I think it's almost all true, yeah. I think there's no question that the neighborhood of Haight-Ashbury that developed in 65 and 66 was just a few thousand people. It was a small neighborhood. The attraction was that rents were low. It was near some colleges, and it was near Golden Gate Park. And Northern California had a tradition of kind of incubating creativity. You know, Allen Ginsberg had first read the poem Howl there. Lenny Bruce was particularly popular there. There was a left-wing subculture there from some of the labor unions. It was an experiment in consciousness and in culture that really involved, like I said, just a couple of thousand people. And, you know, I had a conversation with the Grateful Dead historian and former publicist Dennis O'Malley a couple of months ago, where he said that a lot of the musicians that were there, because the Grateful Dead, the Jefferson Airplane, and Janis Joplin's group Big Brother all had houses in this small neighborhood.
Right.
That they look at 66 as the summer of the actual summer of love for them, when it was innocent, when it was not in the media hothouse, and the summer of love in quotation marks that became a public meme, and that the PBS special appropriately refers to, which was 67, was the death of that, not the birth of it. Because, of course, this small neighborhood couldn't sustain 100,000 people. The city of San Francisco was not about to change their budgetary priorities, you know, and ignore their other needs just because of this. They weren't, a lot of the businesses in San Francisco were not all that excited about all these hippies to begin with. And the delicacy of the idealism and the experiment couldn't handle the overnight fame. And what you said is exactly right. The be-in on January 14th, which attracted at least 35,000 people, some people say it was 50 or 60,000 in Golden Gate Park, was 10 times bigger than any previous hip gathering. There was this idea that some people had in the community to have what they call the gathering of the tribes to invite the diggers, who were the people that were into giving everything away for free, the Berkeley radicals who were focusing primarily on trying to end the Vietnam War, the musicians, some of the people that were experimenting with communal life and the LSD subculture that was so much looking at that time. Again, LSD only became illegal in California in October of 66, so the explosion of availability hadn't happened yet. It was just starting. And so the be-in attracted, you know, in addition to 30 or 50,000 people, you know, hundreds of cameras. And the images from this, I saw it in New York, and, you know, as a high school kid, covered in the local press, and all over the world, these images were on the one hand very exciting and interesting, because it was kind of this alternative way of kind of defining what's life all about. It's not just about accumulating the most money or fame or what you're, you know, university degree is, but some inner spiritual way of looking at life, but without the confinement of rules of thousands of years of some of these religions. And at the same time, you know, the exposure of it killed it, because once it became a media thing, it attracted, like you said, runaways, mentally ill people, predators, people that were, you know, old school criminal dope dealers. And Haight-Ashbury, by the time I enrolled the University of California in Berkeley and visited there for the first time, I was from New York, I visited during the California for the first time in August of 67 and went to Haight-Ashbury, and it was gross by then. You know, it was dirty and ugly and scary and sleazy, whereas just a year earlier it had been idyllic. So there's no question that that the Haight-Ashbury aspect of it, which was the most visible community of the hippie movement, had a short shelf life during which it really was the carrier of that essence. And once it became famous, the energy dissipated and went to the country, went all around the world, entered the art form of a lot of musicians and poets, but was no longer physically in one neighborhood. That neighborhood became kind of a slum.
That's right. You know, so I grew up in Newark, and then I went on to Boston. And in Boston, I remember when I first started school there, I pretty quickly dropped out. I do remember this feeling that epitomizes for me the more gentle innocence that you speak of that really does get lost. I mean, I want to go back for 1 second to something you said about money, which is that we were coming out of the 50s and the post-war economic boom, and this was really, you know, sort of the beatnik and hippie movement coming together saying, hey, wait, we are all one. There may be something else. There may be other simpler values. So I remember when I got to Boston, the most compelling thing I felt was the sense of wordless connection with people on the street. And maybe this still occurs, you know, in goth movement, punk movement, whatever. But for me, coming out of Newark, which had been a pretty political place, I was in SDS and all that, but there was a sense of if you had a certain look or even made eye contact, you know, dudes with long hair, girls dressed the maybe way I was dressed, there was a kind of nod of recognition that I've never experienced since. And it was very moving.
That's certainly my memory of being a teenager at that time. And the characteristic of that subculture was that most of us that were in it had not been all that successful in the mainstream culture. I certainly wasn't. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't a good dancer. I didn't get good grades. So I felt like an outcast and a freak. And suddenly there was this subculture of all people who felt like outcasts and freaks who could embrace other qualities in each other than the four or five that had been sort of sanctioned by society as symbols of attainment. And that was a great relief, and I think that's part of what art could do. I think certainly the punk movement did that for another generation of people who felt like outsiders, and that these kind of subcultures can give people a sense of belonging and a validation of their own particular approach to life that the mainstream culture doesn't always give. Now, the flip side of that is that it can develop into kind of a tribalism with like an inverse snobbery that decides that people who aren't one of us are uncool, insensitive, not compassionate, not as deep in their humanity, and that replicates a lot of the evils of the society to begin with, you know. So I feel that in writing about 67 and reliving it, I was inspired by a lot of what was going on. I took note of the darkness, because there was a lot of darkness then. The Vietnam War was an incredible threat to the livelihood and lives of tens of millions of young men that were subject to the draft, and millions of Asians who got killed. The civil rights movement was going through an explosive period of time. I don't know if you were in Newark when the riots happened, but
I was there just a month after. Awful,
in Newark,
awful, yeah.
And Detroit and many other places. Mm-hmm. You know, as the frustration that the dream of Martin Luther King hadn't transformed quickly enough the opportunity for African Americans. There was a vicious FBI that was, very threatened by all of these questionings of society, far worse than anything we see today. So there was a lot of darkness. There was a lot of light in terms of that sense of community, but there was also a certain amount of clannishness and snobbery that we kind of got. Like in those days, we used to divide people up into straights and heads. And straight in those days meant somebody who didn't get high, who didn't smoke dope or take
psychedelics.
That's
true. That's true.
Heads were those of us that felt we had this new wisdom that we were getting, and I think the psychedelic did do a lot of good for a lot of people, not for everybody, but I think the idea that it created a class of sort of spiritually superior people was not a good path to go down. That just replicates the tribalism and divisiveness and polarity that had already screwed up the world. And so I think that was a mixed blessing, that sense of community. If the sense of community includes loving everybody, like Dr. King
right.
recommended that we do, I think that's the thing to live up to. If it's based on the idea that only people who look like us and listen to the same music as us and take the same drugs as us and dress like, you know, that we're cool and everybody else is uncool, that just replicates all of the tribal problems that have created such a mess in the world to begin with. So I think there were a mixed report card that the counterculture gets for all that stuff.
That's an extremely important point. And then there was this tension between the spiritual and psychedelic aspirations and, I would say, the political rage that was going on. You know, I mentioned before that I had been in SDS. You know, to be in SDS when you're 15, it's a little hard to know why you're there. You know, you have this vague sense of solidarity with the people. Tom Hayden came to Newark. You talk a lot about Tom Hayden, and he organized chapters. And in a strange way, my little posse of friends, I think you might find this interesting, three out of the four of us joined Weatherman. And I realized that my life could have gone very, very differently. But I think that really I went to those meetings kind of for the parties after. And I think that maybe I was fortunate because of all my friends who did go to Weatherman, they had significantly traumatic experiences.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it was a time when we had a government that was so wrong about important things.
Yeah.
The Vietnam War really does not hold up under scrutiny 50 or 60 years later in terms of its supposed rationale. It was supposed to make us safe from communist expansion, and supposedly there was this, what they called the domino theory, that if Vietnam fell, then that would trigger the fall of all of Asia, and then eventually it'd be Japan and Australia, and, you know, change the power dynamic in the world where the Soviet-style communism would threaten us, and you know, that we were supposedly fighting for democracy of the South Vietnamese government versus the tyranny of the North, and those were all lies. I mean, there were no dominoes. At the end of the Vietnam War, when the North won, no other, you know, it didn't threaten Japan, it didn't threaten the United States. Today, Vietnam is a vacation destination for Americans. It's, you know, considered one of the safer places you can go, and the South Vietnamese government was not democratic at all. It was tyrannical, and, you know, so on. But that doesn't denigrate the service and idealism of the people that served in Vietnam. I never felt that the soldiers writ large were the enemy. I felt they were caught up in a system that they didn't control, and a lot of people grew up believing that's what a moral good person did, was to serve your country. Other people had no choice, and you know, but notwithstanding the nobility of service, the war itself was wrong. The people that criticized it were right. The government was putting people in jail for long jail sentences for smoking marijuana. You know, finally, 50 years later, we have a number of states of the union that are decided collectively, you know, not all liberal states either, that you know, it's certainly not as bad for you as alcohol, and the idea of criminalizing it is ridiculous. So I think people were so disappointed in authority because of those two things in particular, and because of people bring their own psychological problems into a political movement and start to blame the government for all their problems too. In certain instances, that there was some people that decided that all traditional ethics and all traditional authority was wrong, and I think out of that impulse and a frustration that the war wasn't ending, you know, created the subculture, like you said, of the Weather Underground that, you know, was really, you know, believed in violence and some sort of violent revolution could make things better. I never believed that. I always was attracted by pacifism and peace and love, and I was against the war, but I was also against any kind of violent protest. But, you know, there were people that really were damaged by that and who damaged others, and there was a lot of confusion within the anti-war movement because, first of all, again, the opposition was profound coming from our government, and secondly, you know, just infighting on the left is unfortunately a long tradition. It had been that way in the 1930s. There was a lot of racial tension where some of the organizations like SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, decided to expel white board members and staffers because they were inspired by Malcolm X's idea of black empowerment. There was arguments in the anti-war movement, again, whether there should be violent or nonviolent approach, whether the electoral lane of trying to elect an anti-war president such as Robert Kennedy was better, or more confrontational tactics, and a very mixed bag. And I don't think that the anti-war movement accomplished a lot of its goals, although I think it did let the establishment know that there was a price to be paid for an unpopular war that I think created some restraint that later people called the Vietnam syndrome, that I think maybe prevented a war or two in the 80s. But it was a very complicated period with dozens, probably hundreds of loud voices, and some of them were just ridiculous and people that I wouldn't want to associate with, and others to me were heroic. To me the great heroes were Dr. King and Allen Ginsberg, and people that really tried to bring a higher loving vibration into a complicated materialistic society. But when you're questioning norms, when you're questioning authority, you get a very complicated, cacophonous group of voices, and not all of them, to me, were grounded in ethics and morality. There were people that entered the counterculture and brought a lot of darkness with them, and that's part of the legacy also. But I still believe that the notion of trying to love everybody is the way to go. And I think that whenever I get lost in trying to think about this, I just go back and listen to Dr. King's speeches and sermons, a lot of which are online, which are far more complicated and sophisticated than the sound bites that you get on the celebrations of his birthday every year. So I do think there's a roadmap of what the real essence was. It was a lot of darkness as well, no question about it, and it was a temporary moment, but a moment that I think worth remembering.
It was so tumultuous. I mean, Todd Gitlin, who's written about the era, said the 60s was like a cyclone in a wind tunnel. And I really like the way your book, In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea, gives that flavor of just how many events in rapid-fire succession were happening. The assassinations, the demonstrations in Chicago, Black Panthers, rise of that. You also mentioned how in the within the political movement there was a lot of racism. Also, as a woman, I experienced a fair amount of sexism. There was a lot of pressure on women to be cool in a certain way. And for some reason, we're still coming out of the 50s, and, dad worked and mom pulled the roast out of the oven. But it was like a leftist curse in a way that the women were. And this is a trope, but I think there's some truth to it. Kind of running the mimeographs and getting the coffee. But I think more oppressive, by the way, more oppressive than that for me was women feeling like they had to just so much go with the flow of the supposition of what would be called free love, and then getting, really damaged and really traumatized. And I don't think enough of that has really been written about, but you do touch on that, and I was very grateful for
well,
that.
Well, there's no question that these, the very imperfect counterculture, and one of the flaws of the initial years of the anti-war movement definitely were it was male dominated, and feminism as an organizing force, or what they call second wave feminism, was just starting to emerge in 67 as some of the women in SDS just formed their own groups and started questioning the macho characteristic of what otherwise was supposed to be a revolutionary movement. And I think it was true in the world that I joined. The rock and roll world was male dominated also. At the same time, there were a lot of prominent gays in the counterculture, but James Baldwin, the great African American writer, Allen Ginsberg, were very public about it. Richard Albert, who later became Ram Dass, was more private in those times about it. But as in the political coalitions at the time, I think gay rights were not treated as seriously until the Stonewall protests in 69, and the launch of what becomes the gay rights movement. So all of these pent up pathologies of Western society that have been going on for centuries there was like all of them suddenly being questioned, and they all the transition into new ways of thinking is bumpy and painful, and doesn't always go in a straight line, as we see today in America. A lot of some of these biases and issues are still prevalent in some parts of the society. But I do think at least the late 60s were a time when some of these assumptions were questioned, and people that were formerly felt powerless started to feel empowered, and it was the beginning of some progress and some solutions. But, you know, by no means was everything perfect.
Oh, of course. And there is a tendency to look back on movements that are very idealistic and have lots of hope and extreme goals and sort of tear it down by saying, but you didn't do this and you didn't do this, you didn't do that, which is, you know, can be a problem. You know, we could have started this interview talking about the music specifically, and we won't have time to do it justice, but would you say that of all the sort of lasting things that the influence of the music and the psychedelic rock and folk rock and all the incredible sources that fed into that, and you cover it beautifully in the book, the Blues People, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, Howlin' Wolf, it was so great for me to hear those names again, you know, has been one of the most significant legacies?
Well, music seemed to have had an ability to survive better than some of the other external manifestations of the hip culture. The clothing and, like I said, some of the language, you know, some of the articles that were in the underground press, things like that, seem extremely dated. And there's something about the nature of music that it speaks to a different part of the brain, different part of the heart, and doesn't survive the passage of years in certain ways. Some of the songs have also been drained of meaning over the years because they've been just in too many movie soundtracks, too many commercials.
Right.
And so, you know, but I still, you know, one of the songs that has been the most licensed, to use the term, you know, the industry term from the 60s, is the Jefferson Airplane's White Rabbit. You know, it must be in 50 movies. It's always like you hear those first chords, those kind of Spanish bolero guitar, and it immediately evokes the thought of trips and psychedelia and mystery and adventure. You know, even as many times as I've heard that song, it still gives me a little bit of a positive chill bumps every time I hear it. Music was also a connective tissue among millions of people who otherwise just wouldn't know that they had things in common. It was shorthand, and because it was cheaper to make a record and you could get it out to the public quicker, it reflected the rapidly changing energies of the counterculture more accurately than novels or movies or theater of the time did. I think Hollywood and the rest of the art world quickly caught up, but there was that period where music was kind of driving the cultural train. And it was exactly at a time when technology was expanding the opportunities for music to connect people. In America, FM radio emerged as an alternative radio format to Top 40, and suddenly you could hear album cuts and the kinds of diversity that were not possible when you're only playing 20 or 30 or 40 hits. Stereos became affordable. When stereos first came out, they were very expensive and just for very wealthy people. And after a decade or so of the technology existing, there were these low-cost stereos, these portable ones that looked like kind of a little suitcase that were like in almost every dorm room. And and the headphones, which previously had just been, again, these very exotic items for people who worked in the industry or in studios, were affordable. And on the recording side, artists and producers had learned how to use stereo recording as a real art form and not just as a gimmick. And, you know, the album that's often given as a key example of that came out in 67, the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It was certainly the peak of the Beatles' career. That year, that's also the year they released the All You Need Is Love, which was shown on satellite TV, the first satellite broadcast ever of any kind. Mm. Like a billion people saw it. So this was a brand new phenomenon, the ability of music to connect people all over the world that quickly. And that we now take it for granted, but that's sort of when that paradigm shift happened was during that period.
Are there any contemporary artists that you, I don't know if you want to say, but, you know, that you feel have been profoundly influenced that you enjoy a lot?
Look, I'm old. I'm in my late 60s now. I turned 67 this year. I don't feel that people of my generation are the ones who are going to decide who the great new artists are. That's people of my kids' generation and younger.
What do you listen to?
I think there are a lot of very... I don't believe God turns off the faucet just because some of us got older. I think that there's very important music being made that's having a deep effect on young people. I just don't always know what it is because I'm not in that generation. But I have no question that the that it's still a tremendous connector, that it speaks an emotional language, that prose and Facebook posts don't necessarily speak, and that there's a sense of community at festivals and at concerts that is still similar for young people today as what music meant to me when I was young. But I don't pretend to follow young artists with great intelligence. I'm pretty much listen to the people I always liked, and then in my professional life, as you know, I have a small talent management company. I work with artists that in a professional manner that I'm proud of. You know, Steve Earle teaches against me some of the other artists, but I just think that the general notion of trying to find another way of defining oneself as a soul instead of just based on your role and external society or the money machine is still very important to artists. I think art is an alternative value system for people, and I think that's been that way long before the 60s, and I think it'll be that way for a long time. Pete Seeger, before he died, used to say if there still was a human race 100 years from now, music would be one of the reasons why.
Oh, I love that. There's a great quote. You quote Bishop James Pike in the book. It says, there is something about the temper and quality of these people, a gentleness, a quietness, an interest, something good. And that was moving, very moving.
Yeah, no, I think there was a moment, again, before the media kind of exploded it and into a million pieces and deprived us of that neighborhood, but allowed far more people to think about these things. In that early stage, I think there was a real kind of alternative way of people trying to live with each other and in their own heads that had a lot in common with ancient religious traditions. And I think that the original, all of the religions in their original sense were the same, connected to love and morality, and that once human beings get involved, it becomes institutionalized, and some of the problems of the secular society enter into those things. But there were religious people at that time, like Bishop Pike, who recognized that this was a movement that was a spiritual movement, even if it wasn't connected to a traditional hierarchy. And that was part of its appeal, that people felt they were personally trying to deal with spirituality, not just enlisting in an organization where they had to check off a lot of boxes.
And I should say, as we wrap up, we've been listening to author Danny Goldberg. The book is In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. And for those of you thinking about getting the book or reading it, I urge you, it's the document that you're going to want to have around, and maybe pass on to your children. These things get lost so in a morass of so many different ideas and so many different approaches. But I should stress, given that most of our listeners to WPKN are huge music fans, and I, of course, was very influenced early on by FM radio, WBAI, and so forth. And, people that could play an 11-minute cut like Dylan's Desolation Row, like you mentioned in the book, that this book has a lot of stuff about music, okay? Because we didn't talk as much about it today, but there's lots of juicy details, and you've worked with and met a lot of people. Danny, I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on and for the nice things you said about the book. And peace, love, and rock and roll.
Peace out.
Later.
Take care.